redicecreations.com. And today we're going to talk about the lightning-scarred planet Mars and the electric sun from the point of view of the electric universe model with David Talbot from the Thunderbolts Project. David is a comparative mythologist whose work offers a radical new vantage point on the origin of ancient cultural themes and symbols. His research has been the primary catalyst behind the Saturn model and is the subject of the feature documentary Remembering the End of the World. He is the author of The Saturn Myth and co-author with Wallace Thornhill on Thunderbolts of the Gods and the Electric Universe. And we'll begin to talk about Mars. This is material coming straight from the Symbols of an Alien Sky, Episode 2. We'll also talk about hemispheric electric discharge, and later, David shares interesting information about the sun, which has brought solar physics to a halt. We'll discuss the sun's anomalous attributes, and David presents a more plausible model of the sun. Welcome back to the program, David. Great to talk to you once again, and just as last time, of course, I'm excited to have you on the program and to continue to talk about the electric universe and the thunderbolts of the gods. Welcome back, David.
Oh, yes, sir, Henrik, and I've been looking forward to this.
Excellent. We have so much to talk about. We want to talk later about the conference here coming up in January. We had you with us almost a year ago now, mid-December thereabouts, and there was another one conference at that point coming up in January as well. So you're doing the same thing this year. So let's go into that later and talk about some of the speakers and everything else.
The second annual conference for us. Yes, indeed.
Great. Now, by the way, we want to talk about Symbols of an Alien Sky Episode 2 with focus on Mars today as well. Have you been following the latest rover landings and looked at some of the results and data coming in at that so far?
Only episodically, Henrik, but what I've seen has been of considerable interest. It's just that trying to keep up with the flow of data from Mars just across the whole spectrum of probes and visual images and rovers and all of this is an incredible burden because the data is just pouring in. And one of the issues, of course, is the concretions or the little spherules. They're now, sometime back with the new rover, Curiosity, they've encountered a whole new category of little spherules on Mars. And because we have demonstrated so clearly that these can be produced effectively only by electric discharge in the laboratory, it becomes a really powerful argument for the hemispheric discharging that is essential to our picture of Mars as reconstructed within the electric universe community, and specifically involving my own work on episode 2 of Symbols of an Alien Sky. So all of this is incredibly inspiring, and I do believe it will all, over time, it will completely change our picture of planetary history. It's that simple.
Yeah, I'm amazed it hasn't already, considering how much you guys have been digging out, because we're as you said, we're learning new things all the time, and we don't know that much about Mars. Well, if we look at it from the point of view of the electric universe, things as usual make sense, but it's very much a mystery if we look at it from the regular academic point of view right now.
Exactly so, Henrik. Our position is that nothing makes sense in the landscape, on the landscape of Mars. All of the formations that we observe are anomalous. And the only way that we can properly approach these anomalies is to consider a radically different vantage point. And the radical vantage point that we have proposed is hemispheric discharging, electric discharging, excavating the hemispheres of the planet Mars up to the level that 6 miles or so were excavated in the northern hemisphere. So it's not just that the northern hemisphere looks different, it's that the crust has been removed, and the planetary scientists who have been involved in measuring the depth of the crust acknowledge that that is so. The crust has been excavated. The only proposal, given the limited frameworks of the mainstream community now, the only proposal that has been made, to the best of my knowledge, is that some great asteroid or comet crashed into Mars in primeval times. But why would that excavate just the crust? It doesn't make even any sense.
Yeah.
Moreover, Henrik, they acknowledge that the moon Phobos of Mars is constituted of the same material as you see on the surface. The same surface material makes up the constituent material on the on the surface of Phobos. Sure hope I don't lose my voice now.
You're doing good.
and that is a telling indicator that activity on the surface has affected even the moons of the planet Mars. There's a whole story to tell there in terms of systematic evidence for electric discharging, carving that planet's surface from pole to pole.
Let's talk about Phobos a little bit more, because it has a huge crater on it on one of the sides. And there, if this was how it was formed, and a crater later impacted there, this body wouldn't flow around in the composition that it has, right?
No, it wouldn't, and also it would have been shattered. Anything capable of producing a crater at that depth would not have left the moon itself intact. This is a small moon of the planet Mars. It is just riddled with craters and crater chains. There is not, when you look closely, there is not a visible crack on that surface. Everything has everything is suggestive of the electric force that acted on Mars acting also on the surface of the planet, of the moon Phobos. And one of the dominant distinguishing characteristics of electric discharge sculpting of a surface is the dominance of crater chains. That's chains of craters in linear and often parallel formations. And you see them all over the moon Phobos. Well, what are those supposed to be in conventional terms? There's no plausible explanation for any of these features, either on Phobos or on the surface of Mars, when you really look more deeply. That's our message.
Hmm. Now, let's talk about the discharge sculpting, and also, of course, what you said, the hemispheric discharging, about how this has redistributed itself across the planet, because we have two different kind of zones, if you will, or hemispheres here of the north and the south. And I guess right in the middle, approximately, of this, we have Valles Marineris, and we've seen that it spread north on the northern hemisphere and south down. Explain this formation to us, and how you think that this has come into being.
That is such an interesting form. Now, to us, the Valles Marineris is the case par excellence for the hemispheric discharging. Now, people within the electric universe community might offer different particular scenarios and so on, but because the hemispheric effects on the planet Mars from the way it engaged other planets, as shown in Symbols of an Alien Sky Part 1, I've come to see the Valles Marineris in terms of the breakdown of a capacitor, where regions of completely different charge are separated by a level of insulation. And that dielectric breaks down, and the result of that is Valles Marineris. And there is a reason why that valley or that great trench arcs northward to the east and southward to the west.
Mm-hmm.
And the configuration to the north is a ravine. The configuration to the south is mountainous terrain. And it is just an established fact that electric discharging to a negative surface will cut a ravine. Electric discharge to a positively charged surface will gather sediment and material into raised ridges. And that's exactly what you have in the two extensions of Valles Marineris to the east and to the west. To the east, it's arcing upward to the north on negatively charged terrain. To the west, it's arcing southward into positively charged terrain. The whole configuration is entirely mysterious. There is no known geologic force that would create a Valles Marineris. And you only have to look more particularly at the nuances of this huge trench to see that it is not flowing water because there are huge chasms that have no outlet. It can't be surface spreading because surface spreading would not create the particular sculpted ridges and dendritic forms which are just massive along the Valles Marineris. It is as if some force unknown to astronomers carved these tree-like, sharply defined ridge systems with the trunks at the top of the ridges and then branching outward as you reach downward. And that form is absolutely consistent along Valles Marineris. For this form, there is only one known force that can produce the configuration, and that's the electric discharge. And it has been known for 150 years or more that you can get raised dendritic systems with electric discharge. But try to find in the geology textbooks, while you're actually looking at the precise sculpting that is involved in these forms, see if you can find any erosional or other formative process that creates anything even close to that.
And, of course, to make things even more interesting, we have Wallace Thornhill have said that he believes this entire formation have actually been created in minutes. How would that be possible? Let's talk about that.
Well, it has to do, actually, with the level of resistance of surface material. I mean, that's one of the considerations. And when you have very high energies of this sort, it isn't unreasonable to think in terms of the speed of lightning, that sort of speed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, you're not talking about events occurring over thousands, millions, or billions of years. You are talking effectively about events that could occur as fast as in minutes. Now, that doesn't need to be a deal killer in discussion of Valles Marineris because there are ways that explosive electric discharge can occur more deliberately as charge redistribution is occurring on a surface. So I wouldn't stake anything in particular on the idea that it occurred in minutes, but that it occurred incomparably faster than any geologic formation arises today is, to me, beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, because this cannot be explained by water. Some of the talk right now is, of course, well, there's been water on Mars, and this is what we see on Earth. And so how do we explain that away? Why is it not water that has formed this formation?
Yeah, well, that's what I love about the dendritic ridge systems, because you can show very readily that erosion would eliminate dendritic ridge systems. Water will flow in a dendritic ravine pattern, but try to imagine water flowing and creating that dendritic form as raised ridges. It's just preposterous. So a huge trench like Valles Marineris, whose defining features include dendritic ridges running, I mean, highly complex ridge systems. It's where the dendritic form is branching once and then again, and this is along ridges that are extending miles into the chasm of Valles Marineris. I'm just saying, we've looked at this in meticulous detail. There is nothing known to science that will do this. It is known very well that electric discharge produces raised dendritic systems.
Very good. Now, let's bring potential newcomers to your work up to speed as well and talk about what can produce this electric discharge. We're talking about an incredible force to be able to make this scar on Mars. So how and why did it happen? Yeah.
Okay, well, now here we have to ask people to be open to the extraordinary possibilities, Henry.
Yeah,
because
sure.
We are talking about planets as charged bodies and an unstable planetary system in the presence of our sun with an electric field extending out to the heliosphere, far beyond the planets. In this electric field, bodies at different positions in relation to the sun are going to be experiencing different levels of charge. But in relation to planetary instability, if you can just allow for the possibility that planets actually once moved in a more chaotic environment, the effects of one planet engaging the another electrically in a plasma environment, that means in a conductive environment, the potential for spectacular electric discharging is self-evident. But you just have to allow for that possibility of irregular, unstable movement and planets engaging each other electrically in that environment. Then you will know with certainty that electric discharge will occur wherever these bodies move into reasonably close proximity to each other. But we're not talking about anything that looks like our planetary system today. The whole purpose of my own work over decades was to establish as clearly as possible, based on human testimony around the world, that the planetary environment was radically different in ancient times. Planets moved in a very close congregation. It was electrically alive. Electrical discharge activity defined that configuration in the sky. And these bodies, in their instability, were the site of spectacular electrical carving of the surface of Mars.
So this doesn't necessarily mean then that it must have been from the closest planet to Mars, closest planets to Mars today, Earth and Jupiter, that have been part of this creation of this discharge.
Yeah, the present planetary system is not a key to the past at all.
Right.
Actually,
yeah.
This reconsideration of planetary past, it just begins with the historical evidence, letting the evidence speak for itself, and really just setting aside all of our assumptions, and that includes our assumption that the ancient sky must have looked a lot like our sky today. The finding is that everything about the ancient sky is a contradiction of our sky today. And I state this categorically. In other words, identify a recurrent memory around the world and you'll always see that it's an anomaly. Well, why is it an anomaly? Because it doesn't point to anything in our sky. And there are hundreds of these anomalies. For this simple reason, Henry, when you work just with the points of agreement between the different cultures, you're actually working with a bedrock of human memory. It's bedrock. That level of archetypal human memory, it's like the substructure of memories around the world.
Mm-hmm.
It is consistently pointing to an alien sky. That's the meaning of symbols of an alien sky. All of the great symbols of humanity in ancient times were pointers to a sky unrecognizable today, but a sky that provoked the entire outpouring of ancient mythology and symbolism and ritual reenactments. Everything you observe in the great monumental cultures is part of this memory, this desire to reconnect and to remember the age of gods and wonders. It has nothing to do with our sky today. But how can you dismiss the power of that memory when you see that every point of agreement, every archetype intersects with every other archetype? Each is illuminating the others. Each is illuminated by the others. It's a completely integral story of an alien sky. That's the message.
And just as we did last Sunday, we need to look at mythology to begin to explain some of this. What does Mars mean if we look at it through the mythic lens? What does it say to us?
Great question. People will recognize this just from the little nuances that they may have picked up of mythology. You know,
sure.
Men are from Mars, women are from Venus. Just that theme alone, which is echoed across thousands of years into the present, actually holds a huge story for us. Why would Mars be inherently masculine? Why would Venus, around the world, be the pointer to the mother goddess? Five visible planets in the sky. Why just Venus as the mother goddess? From China to Polynesia to South America, North America, ancient Egypt, ancient Mesopotamia, India, Iran, everywhere. Venus as the symbol in our sky of the ancient mother goddess. The whole thing is just preposterous. But the point here is that if you don't give in to rationalization or some appeal to sheer coincidence or let's say global dissemination or diffusion of one story and this kind of thing, those rationalizations absolutely do not work when you get into the heart of the story and the total integrity between the different mythic archetypes and the fact that not a single archetype points to something seen in our sky today. I mean, some particular form or some particular movement of the planet, the appearance of the sun, the appearance of the moon. None of these things have any resonance at all with the ancient archetypal picture of the sky.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we look at these objects today and they're far, far away if we even can distinguish them in this way. At least modern man, we're not looking up in that way. But they don't affect us at all directly. And so the question
has to
be... That's
it, exactly, Henrik. And the point to emphasize then is that the ancients didn't look at it this way. These were towering forms. Mars was the towering warrior in the sky. He was the wielder of the cosmic thunderbolt. He was the cosmic thunderbolt. Well, why would a planet, just a little reddish speck in the sky, why would it be so fully identified with the great weapon of the gods? This is a global theme. It makes no sense. Same thing with the mother goddess. Why would that goddess figure be so universally associated with Venus? And you look more closely and you see dozens upon dozens of converging symbols on that same form, this radiant eight-rayed star in the sky, the goddess who rages across the heavens in connection with the story of a dying god. I mean, these things make no sense whatsoever, but the raging mother goddess is so universal. This is the ancient symbol of beauty, the love goddess, the spectacular glory of heaven, becomes a serpent or dragon, a hag or witch, roaring across the sky, bemoaning the death of her husband or lover. I mean, this is a very complex story, and I just oversimplified it. But the themes are there, and they can be elaborated in the most extraordinary detail, and the integrity only grows.
Yeah.
You never see integrity being lost through the more complete version of an archetypal story. It's always confirming underlying integrity.
So what made Mars the warrior and its companions as well, that we have many warriors that seem to be associated with Mars as well, or that it came with many warriors, right?
Well, the multiplicity of the warrior figure is one of the complex features of world mythology that has to be very carefully unraveled, because every tribe had its own heroic figure, and only a minority of tribes preserved the astronomical traditions. They just remembered their great ancestral warrior. And then along came chroniclers 1,000 years, 2,000 years after these events, and in order to weave coherent epic literature, they wove together all of the tribal tales of the great warriors, only making sure that their warrior, an Aeneas, let's say, was ultimately the great victor, certifying their own national right to rule the land, because cultures were being assimilated continuously over thousands of years, and politics ultimately came to determine whose warrior got to be the supreme warrior in the sky. For the Latins, this was the god Mars, because that's where we get our name for the planet Mars. But other planet, other tribes use completely different names, of course. And it takes a lot of systematic comparison to see that wherever the astronomical traditions are recorded in sufficient detail, Mars is always a great thundering warrior in the sky. But what was the cosmic thunderbolt? Why does that form? I mean, it's recorded on stone. It's recorded in ancient manuscripts. The look of the cosmic thunderbolt amongst the Greeks is very elaborately displayed. It's ludicrous. It doesn't look anything like lightning. So when we discovered that it is the form of electric discharge in the laboratory, and that form in the laboratory can be scaled up to stellar and even galactic dimensions. We see it in the bipolar forms of galaxies, in the bipolar forms of nebulae and so on. That's the form of the cosmic thunderbolt, a bipolar discharge form. That was centered on the planet Mars, and that explains why Mars was identified as his weapon, the thunderbolt. But the story is also so much bigger than this, because, I mean, we see stories about the great warrior with his magical arrow. It never misses the mark. And his sword and spear and all these different weapons, axes and the like. What isn't properly appreciated is that the archetype behind all of those weapons of great warriors was the cosmic thunderbolt. And guess what? The best experts on archetypal mythology actually recognized this before I even started my work.
Yeah.
René Guénon, he said the archetype in every country, the archetype of the hero's weapon was the thunderbolt. See, I didn't even know that when I started. But there's so much more integrity in all of this than anybody will even believe possible until they actually begin considering the bedrock of evidence. That bedrock is composed entirely of the points of agreement between the different cultures. So you never want to start this study looking at a particular myth and trying to understand it, you know, a particular regional story. You will end up trying to diagnose the story of King Arthur or the story of Atlantis on the basis of just a few paragraphs in a particular region where nothing is actually even understandable until it is illuminated by the global archetypes. Then you see that these localized stories that we've tried to understand in isolation can't possibly be understood in isolation. The pointers come from the points of agreement between the different cultures, and there are hundreds of them.
Indeed. Now, if we go back and look at the surface of Mars, we see rocks spread all over it in various different sizes. We have something that looks like craters that have been hidden, shall we say, by dust, sand, and rocks as well. And it's a very interesting way how this has happened. Explain how this has come about, because we have also a lot of rocks from Mars on Earth. So something big happened here, David.
And is it a coincidence that ancient astronomers said meteorites fall from Mars? They wouldn't be engaged in chemical analysis to prove that the chemical composition contained within that rock and the little bubbles in that rock are a perfect match of the atmosphere of Mars. But they knew nevertheless. And then this was this connection of meteorites to the lightning-scarred planet Mars was lost for centuries and centuries. Then we began to investigate unique meteorites and find that they harbor the atmosphere of Mars. But here's another consideration. They're identifying these meteorites as fallen from Mars by an atmospheric signature. But if a planet was excavated 6 miles deep in its northern hemisphere, that would be the smallest percentage of meteorites produced, of the rocky bodies thrown into space.
Mm-hmm.
Most would not exhibit the atmosphere of Mars at all. So how many more than those explicitly identified Martian meteorites have actually fallen on Earth to redeem the ancient idea that Mars was the planet that hurled meteorites?
Yeah, very, very interesting. Now, is there any way, by the way, with the data that we have available at this time, that we can know when these spectacular events took place, David?
It never fails that I do a presentation and somebody wants to know the calendar.
Yes, I know. I did this last time too as well.
Because it's such a legitimate question. And there's no fixed calendar. There's only a relative calendar. And the events preceded the rise of the great monumental cultures. Because if you removed the events, the cultural content wouldn't be there. In other words, the cultures arose completely out of traumatic, spectacular, mind-altering cosmic events. And this is why every monumental culture was commemorating the Age of Gods and Wonders. And that's all they were doing. This is the hardest thing for people to realize, is that the distinguishing characteristics of the cultures as a whole, at the dawn of civilization, they were all commemorative. That's why we call them monumental cultures.
Mm.
They were building monuments to the gods. They were reenacting in their ritual and magical practices, such as all of the kingship rites and sacred marriage rites and New Year's festivals. They were reenacting critical junctures in the Age of Gods and Wonders. There's nothing else that you observe as collective content of the early cultures. Nothing. I mean, even in the agricultural rites, you would think that, well, they had to eat, so they grew food and so on, raised cattle and this sort of thing. Yes, but in their actual magical, collective, creative expressions of those necessities, they were dominated by ritual reenactments. The harvest festivals and all the rest were ritual reenactments of critical junctures in the Age of Gods and Wonders.
It would be a shame to talk about Mars without mentioning the tallest mountain on any planet that we know of in the solar system, Olympus Mons. What is this, David?
Well, it's obviously a volcano. No, it's not a volcano. And we can show that it's not a volcano by more meticulous examination of the morphology involved. The scarp is not the scarp on Mars, of Olympus Mons. It's miles high. And shield volcanoes, as Olympus Mons is so identified, do not reveal scarps of that sort. But that's actually just the beginning. There's no indication of a vent to subsurface volcanic outflow and so on. There is a series of so-called calderas with very flat floors and scalloped walls to those calderas, and down those walls flow the key signature that I've already mentioned here of electric discharge in a dusty plasma environment, and that is dendritic ridge systems. The same dendritic forms run right down those scarps, almost vertically. No known explanation within the lexicon of science for that dendritic pattern, and no volcano that exists on Earth today exhibits that kind of a scarp with dendritic ridge systems, raised dendritic ridges, sharply cut, running right down the scarp. Then there is the corona around the base of Olympus Mons. That entire formation is sharply cut by huge valleys, not ravines cut by erosion or anything of that sort. It's a crisscrossing form that matches the coronal forms of electric discharge to lightning arresters and that sort of thing. It's a perfect match, in fact. Now, I stumbled, possibly, Henry, when I gave the name Corona to that particular form.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Lightning Scarred Planet Mars, our episode 2 of Symbols of an Alien Sky, this is treated in considerable detail, and you can see the perfect match between the surrounding base of a blister on a lightning arrester and other electric discharge forms, and that set of sharply cut forms around the base of Olympus Mons. Even the trench around the base of Olympus Mons is a match to that particular form.
That's right. There have been tests on with an electric arc on clay, basically, right? And this lightning blister exhibits the identical characteristics, pretty much, as
I should have mentioned that first, actually, Henrik, because Wal Thornhill, who really is the preeminent spokesman for the electric universe paradigm, did the experiment that did prove that the defining features of Olympus Mons are recreatable in the laboratory with electric discharge to a positively charged surface.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah,
that too is given. The actual video of that experiment is given in the lightning scarred planet Mars.
That's right. And again, the scale here, people might be amazed at the scale, but does this have to do then just how much electricity the charges, the energy of this thing, and therefore it would create such a magnificent tall mountain, no problem?
Yeah, I think that we're dealing with planetary bodies, charged bodies interacting in space, and the level of energy is fully capable under those circumstances of carving the surface of a planet. And there is nothing unusual, nothing forbidden in scaling up a laboratory experiment to planetary dimensions. There will be variables that come into play, but the basic energy requirements and the basic forms taken by electric discharge are highly scalable.
Indeed. How far apart do you think the planetary bodies would have to be before a discharge begins to happen? Is there any tests that have revealed some of this?
Well, that actually would take me out of my comfort zone to talk about the mathematics of energies and discharge capabilities between charged bodies and the nature of the plasma environment that would be required. But we do know that plasma, which is the interplanetary medium, and it is the interstellar medium, and it's the intergalactic medium, the charged particles in a rarefied plasma environment will be highly conductive. The denser the plasma, the more conductive will be that environment. So it's likely to me that the plasma environment through which the planets moved in an earlier time was a richer, more dense environment, and there was room for spectacular electric discharging energetically between bodies at different distances. But the most important consideration here is to set aside any thought about the distances of planets today.
Mm-hmm.
This was a close congregation of planets. From an earthbound perspective, we saw towering forms in the sky. These forms were defined by electrical activity. So plasma or electrical discharge activity in plasma gave these celestial bodies their unique forms. I've talked about often the spectacular column that stretched down from Mars to the Earth. It was the World Mountain, the World Pillar, a heaven-sustaining giant, and that was one of the characteristics of the great warrior figure. He held aloft the visible sky. His body was that of the World Mountain or the World Pillar. So for a proper appreciation of what was actually seen in ancient times, you have to imagine these bodies being larger, the spheres themselves, at least in their close proximities to Earth, being substantially larger than the Moon in our sky. Add the plasma environment and all of the electrical activity going on between them, and this was an evolving, metamorphosing configuration in the sky. It was simply stupendous. Stupendous.
And, of course, for the full story on this, we recommend that you take a look at Symbols of an Alien Sky, and you can also go back and listen to the first program we did with David Talbot, where we talk about the polar configuration and how this was formed and everything, and we've kind of detailed that there. But so we can leave that for now, David, since we spent so much time on that already, but it's absolutely fascinating. But if we look at the so-called caves and lava tubes on Mars, there's other kind of formations. Is these assessments that you agree with, or again, is there another explanation for some of these patterns?
Yeah. I never believed for a moment that the collapsed lava tube theory of crater change and so on Mars. And to appreciate my skepticism on that, you would just have to go through the comparison. Now, this is well presented in the DVD on the Lightning Scarred Planet Mars, but always look for the acid test. I mean, if this is just surface collapse, and there's a lava tube, the empty space of a lava tube beneath the surface that is collapsing into that lava tube, surely you would find, as you do on one lava tube collapsed after another on Earth, you would find entry points where you could actually peer into the void. It never happens. There's no evidence anywhere on Mars that these change of craters are collapsed lava tubes. You cannot see a single entry point into the void supposedly beneath. And just look at the lava tubes on Earth where people walk into them. You know, it would be the easiest thing in the world to prove that these are lava, these are collapsed channels or collapsed tubular forms of some kind. It would be the easiest thing in the world. There is no evidence whatsoever.
They're doing some kind of, NASA is going to map out some kind of cave area. This is kind of recent news coming out, so I have to keep an eye on that, but we'll see what that reveals. And again, you guys have been watching a lot of the developments by NASA.
And I'll tell you what, if I ever see anything remotely indicative of a collapsed lava tube, I'll be the first to stand up and say, well, I can't make the categorical statement again. And you may be talking about the deep penetrating holes that they see on Mars.
Yeah, I think
that's a completely different issue. That's on the side of, I'm forgetting, it may be Ascrius, Mons. You have these kind of light windows where you can peer deeply down into a cavernous empty space.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is not proposed to be a collapsed lava tube or anything of that sort. And by the way, in laboratory experiments, you get that kind of thing electrically all the time. So there would have to be other information brought forward before there was any reasonable interpretation one way or another. The collapsed lava tube theory has been around for a long time, and it was used to interpret Schroeder's Valley, for example, on the Moon. But we eventually examined that surface very carefully. There is no evidence, again, of collapse at all. When you look at a collapsed lava tube, the roof that has collapsed is a heap of rubble. You don't see this on these supposed collapsed lava tubes on Mars at all.
Interesting. Yeah, very, very interesting. Let's shift over and talk more about the Sun, David. You had some interesting information about this, and I guess it also ties into Mars to a certain extent, but tell us about the Sun and how this...
I believe that the Sun could well be, I mean, along with comets and planetary starring and other things, but the Sun actually could rise to the highest priority for us now, because since Ralph Jurgens, the engineer, in 1972 proposed that the Sun is a glow discharge in our sky, not a thermonuclear furnace. we have, of course, wanted to follow the evidence that was, you might say, predictable under the electric sun hypothesis. In electrical terms, just as one of many examples, in electrical terms, if the sun is discharging in reaction to a massive electrical environment extending out to the heliospheric boundary, you're going to look for things completely different from what a scientist, a solar physicist, would look for as a manifestation of a nuclear or thermonuclear furnace at the sun's core. Now, if there are million degrees temperatures at the core of the sun, and that is being continually fueled by a thermonuclear reaction, then you must have an escape of that temperature, and you must have then visible convection at the surface of the sun. It's an absolute requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody denies that. Now, Ralph Jurgens, 1972, he said to claim that convection is occurring on the sun, it requires you to see things that are never observed in true convection. That argument by Ralph Jurgens was completely ignored. But I began to explore the sun myself 3 years ago. And I was interested in this convection issue, and I continued to look for proof of convection, not the computer models and simulations in which they repeated or reproduced in a virtual world what they think is going on, but actual proof that convection is occurring, specifically overturning convection. That's the hot plasma rises against the gravity of the sun, and then it cools and it falls back, so on. And I could not find any proof whatsoever. And then I found it had to be one of the most sophisticated, possibly the most sophisticated studies at the ideal position on the sun at a particular time. And this study, it concluded we cannot find evidence of convection on the sun in this particular region where it should be most evident. Then, I mean, this was 3 years ago. Okay. Then, just a few months ago, there was this massive MRI, so to speak, of the sun where they were trying to develop the relationship between this massive convection that must be occurring if it's a nuclear furnace and the magnetic field of the sun. So convection, the moving plasma, must be what's creating the magnetic field of the sun. So let's really look at this. They got effectively goose eggs. They could not see through their system more than 1% of the convection that the model absolutely demanded. This, Henrik, was just a few months ago.
Hmm.
Now, I thought, well, it's happened. Solar physics brought to a screeching halt. Now, what actually happened? The announcement went out and people scratched their heads. Did one person, did one peer-reviewed journal, did any respectable solar physicist raise his voice and say, you know, it looks as if the thermonuclear furnace isn't there?
Hmm.
Not one person.
Wow.
And in 50 years of peer-reviewed research on the sun, not one article has ever been published suggesting that an external electric field could be responsible for the behavior of the sun and explain all of its anomalies. And in fact, all of the defining attributes of the sun are anomalous. They're not explained. They don't appear on any chain of reasoning from a nuclear furnace to the anomalous attribute, like the heating of the corona.
Yeah.
You get farther away from the surface and it gets hotter. That's hardly the kind of thing you would expect from a heated core of anything.
Right. Yeah.
The acceleration of the solar wind away from the sun. I mean, in the extreme cases of coronal mass ejections, up to a quarter the speed of light. Now, what is the force known so well to science that accelerates charged particles? Just one thing, an electric field. But does the discovery of this rapid acceleration of the solar wind cause solar physicists to wonder is it possible that the sun is the center of an electric field and that that is what is accelerating charged particles to such velocities? In the laboratory, you can get that kind of acceleration across inches with an electric field.
Wow.
Just inches. And that's just the beginning. Henrik, there around the equator of the sun, there is something called the super-rotating atmosphere. The equator is doing exactly the opposite of what an equator should do in an island, like if the sun is just an island and not being driven at all by in any way by its external environment. The equator would rotate the most slowly. This is well established. In other words, it would take longer to complete a revolution than, say, the circumpolar atmosphere. But it runs around 36 revolutions for every 25 revolutions of the circumpolar plasma of the sun. A total contradiction. But if it is a rotating electric field that is driving the anomalous rotation of the solar atmosphere, where's the mystery? And the same thing with the rotation of this torus around the equator of the sun. It's completely anomalous. And why would a nuclear furnace produce a rotating external torus at all anyway?
Yeah.
None of these things make any sense. And that's just the beginning, because there are so many defining attributes of the sun now. They all contradict the model. There's nothing that fits the model. That's the truth of the matter. Not anything actually fits the model, other than that the sun is big and it has a strong gravity. The fact that particles don't pay any attention, charged particles don't pay much attention at all to that gravity, is the real issue. And you have polar jets, which are a defining characteristic of an electric discharge phenomena. It's very curious. Now, listen, I know I'm maybe talking a little too fast here, but there is a fact that is occurring in the background right now, I just want to mention.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, we are in direct conversation with people at the top of data gathering on the sun for years.
Mm-hmm.
Now retired.
Okay.
Now retired. And the word is, the solar fusion model of the sun has totally failed.
Yeah.
Totally failed. And they are coming in. I have to be careful what I'm saying. I hope I didn't speak too much out of school, but I don't think I have here. I'm just telling the truth here, that the solar physicists from the top of data gathering, that is, they were responsible for gathering data, they were involved deeply with the instrumentation, gathering data and disseminating it to solar physicists globally. The nuclear fusion or thermonuclear fusion model of the sun has failed catastrophically. That's what we hear. So now what we are witness to is the momentum of prior belief just going on as if nothing has happened.
Wow. Does this mean, though, at the end that the current model will have to give away for another theory here?
Well, there's a reason why we called our upcoming conference the tipping point, because
right.
The tipping point isn't just a psychological thing, though obviously there's a momentum of an idea that is psychologically going to ultimately overrun the momentum of traditional physics. Now, that's just what we see happening here. But more than anything else, when we say the tipping point, we are talking about foundational, undeniable fact. And you can look at the behavior of comets, which we haven't even talked about. You can look at the planetary scarring of surfaces such as that of the planet Mars. You can look at the sun. You can look at stellar evolution. You can look at galactic evolution. All of the bedrock of fact that we are talking about is, in fact, undeniable. That nobody denies it. The problem is posed by the specialized sciences not paying sufficient attention to what is happening outside their exceedingly narrow field of view. This is what enables them to go on looking for convection after it's been made clear that convection does not occur on the sun. And this is becoming such a huge force within a community. I mean, there's an electric universe community. Somewhere between 25 and 30 PhDs have come into this community just since the first of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And what they are seeing is the broad interdisciplinary, completely definitive evidence that we live in an electric universe. So it is the tipping point. This is a point of highest confidence within this whole electric universe community now.
Very, very interesting. Let's talk more about this right away. It's the conference upcoming here for 2013 is in Albuquerque, January 3rd to the 6th. And as you say, the subtitle for this year's conference is The Tipping Point. Tell us about some of the speakers that will be attending.
Yes, indeed. I'd like to do that. And maybe first I can say, if your listener can just remember this simple URL, Thunderbolts, plural, thunderbolts.info. Because if you go to the thunderbolts.info website, you will see a banner on the homepage for the conference, Electric Universe 2013, The Tipping Point, January 3rd to 6th in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And we do have really a stellar group of speakers, and it is actually a very interesting juncture for us now because we are extending our interest from the electric behavior of planets and stars and galaxies into the electricity of life. And people are coming now into our group from backgrounds in biology and subtle energies and bioenergetics and bioengineering and so on. And Gerald Pollack, who does appear to be happy to stand up and announce himself as a member of the EU community, and we never ask people to do this, never, but he's a professor of bioelectric engineering at the University of Washington, and he is a true pioneer in the field of the electricity of life or structured water, the electrical attributes of water being a key to whole new fields of revelation within the biological sciences. So there's been a tremendous marriage between the electric universe as it was being stated publicly 10 years ago and as it and the biological sciences looking at the electricity of life. And Gerald Pollack is a beautiful example of that. And his colleague, Maewon Ho of England, is a pioneer in the field, has been for 20, 30 years. More, I think, is the keynote speaker at our Thursday evening event, Maewon Ho. But if you go to the conference page on our website, you will see a very substantial menu to the right, from home to register to theme, speaker schedule, media and press, location and hotel, scholarships and other things. And it will give you the full picture.
Indeed.
The conference.
Indeed.
And I can tell you that the speakers are, Rupert Sheldrake, internationally distinguished within the alternative science field, but he has helped to create a pathway forward with his ideas of morphic resonance. And that's all it's all preposterous to the scientific mainstream looking at biological systems.
But who cares, right?
But he's presented such an intelligent case that it's not this simple, folks.
That's
right.
Yeah.
That human living systems are connected. We see evidence piled upon evidence. How did it happen? Just as in the physical sciences and so on, the evidence piles up and nobody will pay attention to it.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you look at the soft underbelly of the whole culture of science and what the debunkers and the so-called skeptics say, they mention Rupert Sheldrake and their language will be scandalous.
Yeah.
It's reprehensible conduct to take anyone of the caliber of the people that are coming into our circle and start using words like you see being thrown around by people who are completely uneducated on the subjects. This is the state of science today, and we do have to get worked up a little bit just temporarily when we talk about it because it's reprehensible. It's not right to use words like crackpot science and so on just because somebody has brought forth clear evidence that long-standing assumptions are not correct.
It's ridiculous. It's childish behavior. It shouldn't be like this. It should look at the material and then decide after that point. But the majority of people who are critical, they don't even look at the material. They dismiss this out of hand because
by their own admission, they don't look, and they don't need to look because they already know. That's what we hear from that crowd. So that's as much as I need to say on that phenomenon, Henry.
Yeah.
People have to see it for themselves.
Indeed.
And the best way to see all of this for yourself is to actually pay attention to what the critics are saying and then compare that to what is being said by the people they are actually criticizing and make your own judgment. Never take the use of the word crackpot and so on that it is being thrown around on the internet. Never take that at face value. There is another dimension here too, and this is why do we, for our part, allow or ask people to come in anonymously if they're nervous about the name calling and so on. We give everybody the opportunity to come into the conference if they have a distinguished position without being named. And they come in as anonymous observers. We are having spectacular success in that, going in that direction. So there is some point that will come in the next year or two or three. You can't predict the length of this period of transition in the tipping point. But the point will come where people who have remained anonymous are bolstered by the sheer numbers of others who are remaining anonymous, and they can collectively stand up and affirm that it is all electric. We live in an electric universe, and there won't be anything to fear by being part of that announcement.
That's right.
Right now, it would be precarious for many people. You just have to hear the stories of what happens to people when they evolve within their own independent research a challenge to a mainstream assumption. It's a very unpleasant story.
Yeah, unfortunately, and it's also, I mean, evidence should be the driving factor here, not consensus or whatever happens to be the accepted theory at the time. And it's ridiculous that people are still kind of ousted, I guess, just because speaking for or against something. We're all trying to figure out what's going on here, folks. Slow down and relax, you know. So
there you go, Henrik. I like what you just said.
Yeah.
And the message should be just that simple. In the end, I do believe that there's such a crowd of physicists and scientists that have worked with integrity but simply been unaware of
sure.
foundational challenges.
Yeah.
And that crowd is beginning to awaken now, and it will make all the difference in the world.
Well, it means that we're learning and we're slowly, coming forward here, although that there's tremendous resistance. But, I mean, I'm very glad that you guys are focusing on that tipping point, of course, because it's very important. And the more of the consensus is falling apart, the more room there is for you guys to come in the picture and present your point of view as well. So that's really encouraging. Very, very good.
Indeed so. And so if I could just repeat the website.
Sure, go ahead,
Henrik. It's thunderbolts.info, and on the home page you have the banner, which takes you directly to all of the information on the conference. Also, the website does contain huge volumes of information that will be of interest to people that are exploring this subject. Oh, and incidentally, Henrik, I should probably mention that we are finding that beyond the website, there's a simple way to get into explorations of the electric universe through YouTube.
Sure.
And if now let's see. Okay, this will be just slightly self-serving, but it's worked really well. I mean, it's very popular. I did a talk at last year's conference. It was called Seeking the Third Story. It's been extremely well received. If you go to YouTube and you look up Seeking the Third Story, you'll go directly to that talk, and it is the whole talk. And then, of course, you can click on the Thunderbolts Project channel, and you will see at least a dozen space news videos brought to you by the Thunderbolts Project.
Indeed.
And
yeah.
These brief videos are transforming our presence on the Internet right now. We're now getting 6 times the number of daily subscribers that we were getting just 3 months ago.
Oh, wow. Catching momentum. So that's great. Really, really encouraging.
Feeding the idea of the tipping point, quite frankly.
Indeed. Now, once again, here then, the Electric Universe Conference here in 2013 called The Tipping Point is in Albuquerque, New Mexico, January 3rd to the 6th. And again, thunderbolts.info is the website for more information, of course, about the speakers, where you can learn more, and, of course, pick up tickets as well. So I hope you guys that are interested will attend this very, very important presentation, and it goes for 3 days there. So very, very good. Thank you again, David, for returning back with us here again. We're going to take a short break, but thank you for the first hour, David. Looking forward to continuing.
Yes, indeed. Thanks, Henrik. Bye for now.
All right, that's it for today. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back with more in just a few days. We're going to have John Major Jenkins with us next. And this is going to be the first of the final two programs that we're going to do about the 21st of December and the end of the Mayan calendar topic. The second program is a roundtable with Jay Widener, Barbara Hanclo, and Lawrence Joseph. Don't miss that one. In between these two, we're going to spend an hour with G. Edward Griffin talking about the collectivist conspiracy. Find us at redicecreations.com. You can follow our radio program when it pleases you, download or stream. And at redicemembers.com, you have access to our full archives. Stay well, stay cool. We'll talk more soon.